But there are a few things in life where it is worth standing up and saying, enough is enough. This is wrong. This is, you know, this is beneath contempt. We are not a people that should be so fearful or so vengeful that we think that torture is somehow acceptable. On what level could torture ever be acceptable? No, we should make a stand on this. She should never leave the CIA. And one other reason is they have such enormous power to destroy lives. They can listen to all the phone conversations of the world. They can assassinate people with drones. We should not have someone at the top who has actually been an advocate of or a participant in torture.
That was Rand Paul talking about Gina Haspel's selection by the Trump administration to lead the CIA. I am Catherine Mangu Ward, filling in for Matt Welsh here on the Reason podcast today. I am joined by Nick Gillespie, editor-at-large. He is lurking in Ohio. Say hi, Nick.
Hello.
And here in D.C., I have Peter Suderman, managing editor of Reason.com, and very special guest star Elizabeth Nolan Brown, who is going to fill us in on a bunch of different topics, including some stuff we're going to cover today. Cambridge Analytica, are they hackers who have caused a giant breach or just people using data for things? We're also going to talk about looming trade negotiations, looming budget negotiations, and other looming topics. Thank you for joining us here on the Reason Podcast, where you should subscribe, go to iTunes, rate, review, send us notes about how you wish Matt Welsh would come back and run this whole thing. Let's get started first, though, with some torture, as we always do here at Reason. We've got Gina Haspel. She is either famous or infamous, depending on how you slice it. Rand Paul is saying he's going to use all the tools at his disposal to stop her from becoming the CIA director, partially because she is gleeful. She has joyful glee. She has gleeful joy about torture. Nick, is Rand Paul's approach the right one?
Yeah, I think so. I'm happy to see Rand Paul take a stake against, just blithely waving through people who are pro-torture. Torture is a bad idea for moral reasons. It also does not seem to work particularly well. But more importantly, from my point of view, I like the fact that Rand Paul seems to be getting his groove back on and really pushing an alternative framework in politics where he believes in limited government, and where for many Republicans, certainly, and oftentimes conservatives of either party, you could say, you know, limited government means never having to say you're sorry about a foreign policy, bombing other countries, or torturing people who are suspected terrorists. And I think by Rand Paul actually going in a libertarian direction of saying the government should have less power, and extending that to something like torture issues and the CIA, which has a long and bad history of overstepping its legal restraints.
This is kind of my favorite Rand Paul, the like, I'm just going to filibuster and be a jerk about it because Republicans have no moral compass on the conduct of sort of war broadly, but particularly these sub issues that he cares about.
Yeah, like, or
national security,
surveillance
more broadly,
state,
even. Yeah.
Yes, national security. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's a really important way of, you know, fleshing out what libertarians believe, because after 30 years since Reagan or something, where you could get away with saying I'm for limited government, government isn't the solution, government is the problem, except then when the biggest problem, and Donald Trump is saying this now, and Republicans and many Democrats are happy to jump on. Government's the problem, except when it comes to funding more and more spending on defense, on security, on intelligence, on stuff like the TSA, you know, which isn't making us safer, but it makes us all a little bit poorer and a little bit later getting to where
this also became
going.
A little bit of a media story. Liz, there was a ProPublica report, which basically, I think it's fair to sum it up as Gina Haspel personally tortured everyone all day long for her whole career. And then some of that had to be retracted. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how we cover both how Trump's appointments have been covered, but also the kind of fallout from the way that ProPublica covered the story and then had to retract?
Yeah, I mean, it's disappointing because it's not like the points that that everyone has been making about Gina Haspel are wrong. And it's not like their things were wrong, but the, you know, the things she did were bad enough. And the fact that they got it, that so many people got the story wrong and said she did things that were just like a little bit worse in the realm of torture, that's already pretty bad. So it gave an opening for people who want to oppose the critics of her to be like, well, you know, you guys can't even get your story right. And she's probably not even as bad as everyone's saying. And for her supporters to really kind of have that, like, you know, foothold in to sort of criticize anybody who's criticizing her as just being kind of full of crap.
We have a kind of truthiness problem here, right? I mean, it is never an adequate defense on the part of journalists to say, well, the core ideas of this story were true, even if the facts
right,
were not.
Right.
But at the same time, it seems pretty clear that the core ideas of this story were true.
And when Nick was talking about Rand Paul too, I feel like libertarians that are like in a really long, extended, sort of abusive relationship with Rand Paul, where he just lets us down so spectacularly by going against like everything he says he's for all the time. But then he does some great thing like this, where he makes some spectacular big gesture of actually like caring about civil liberties again. And you're just like, oh, Rand, we can't quit you, but you know.
This is the equivalent of him showing up to Reason's door with like a box of chocolates and a nice bouquet, and he's
maybe,
like, here, I got you this anti-waterboarding filibuster.
Yes, exactly.
And we're like, oh baby, okay,
like, oh, all right,
come on back in. Peter, do you feel like
I feel frozen out of
oh sorry did the ladies
Peter,
make you feel excluded from a conversation about politics, Nick?
Well, you know, it's like
Peter, yeah, do you feel excluded?
Rand Paul can bring me flowers and chocolates anytime he
or filibusters,
and sometimes does.
I mean,
be honest,
he knows where our office is.
I like the filibusters with the creamy centers.
Wrong, the coconut filibusters are the best one.
Oh, the coconut ones. Those are the ones you save for the
filibuster. Is actually a great type of whiskey, and I recommend it to anybody watching a filibuster, because you're going to need it to get through one of those things. No, I mean, this is sort of classic Rand Paul stunt politics, and I mean this that in pretty much the best possible way, right? Like, he is deciding to use his platform in a high profile way on a high profile issue to make a stand, but really to make a statement. And that is something that that libertarians rarely sort of get from anybody in the Senate, a clear, high profile statement of principle that we agree with. And so that is something that like, I mean, you know, that I think we should be, even if we are often frustrated with Rand Paul in many other ways, that is something that we should be appreciative of, and that we should be supporting.
Peter, do you think the distinctions in the Haspel coverage matter? That is, you know, there's been sort of some questions about whether she was, you know, mocking or gleeful. A lot of it is about kind of her attitude toward torture, but also her explicit, you know, role in authorizing specific conduct. How important do you think those details are? And you know, how much does it matter if we get them right?
It
is important to get things right.
I mean, no, it matters a lot. Just totally independent of the relevance of any story, it matters that journalists get stories, get important details right. On this particular story, I think it actually matters more. And I think that it is fair to look at this and say the media has got it wrong, and that there was a lot of bad reporting, misreporting based on ProPublica, which is in general a really reliable source, one that you can trust to get this sort of thing right. But they basically got Haspel, when Haspel started at the overseeing this black site, wrong. And so all of the stuff that they thought she oversaw a bunch of the stuff that they thought she oversaw was overseen by a different director. Now, part of this is just the extreme difficulty of covering black sites, right? I mean, they're black sites, which means they don't tell you what they do at them and who's running them and where they are, right? And so getting that information out and to the public is very difficult for even the most diligent and conscientious journalists to do. In this case, they tried, they got it wrong, quite wrong, issued basically an article length correction, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff. The New York Times has has also had to weigh in on this because the New York Times has published similar reports, as have several other news organizations. And that's not something where that I think people should just sort of blow off and say, well, that's, you know, that happens. And yes, it does happen. It shouldn't. And it should. And we and journalists should make, even when there's, even when the story is in many ways kind of fundamentally right, she did oversee a black site, just not when during all of the months that the ProPublica report initially said, and she didn't make the specific comments about like, isn't it funny that this guy's being tortured that were initially reported? It's still something that's really worth sort of that's worth taking care to get right and making kind of a fuss about when you get it wrong.
So the Haspel pick is part of a broader shakeup in the administration. I think it's actually interesting that we've wound up having a little minute here to talk again about the ethics of torture in the context of yet another story about how the entire staff of the Trump administration is changing every single week. But Paul has said that he's going to filibuster Pompeo as well, who is rotating out of the seat that Haspel's going to be picked for and into Rex Tillerson's spot. Is there stuff we should be paying attention to in that transition that we're missing because we're all shouting about torture, or is torture the right thing to be shouting about here, Nick?
Yeah, I think the larger question is what's the function of the Secretary of State under Donald Trump? And this isn't, you know, some kind of constitutional matter necessarily, but different presidents put more, you know, there's oftentimes a debate or a fight between factions. You know, does a Secretary of State dominate? Does a National Security Advisor dominate in a particular administration? And you could see that even in George W. Bush, where Colin Powell was ultimately, you know, kind of ousted in any kind of meaningful way from having a lot to say about policy or even being heard. And Tillerson was clearly, you know, not quite with the Trump program. So, you know, there's always that kind of infighting, I think, for influence and power in administration. I think what is more important here is that you have people like John McCain really using this as an opportunity to talk about why he is anti-torture. And it may give us a brief moment, less talking about torture and more about what is foreign policy at this point in the Trump administration, because it also bleeds very clearly into trade policy, into immigration policy, into a lot of stuff, you know, that is, it's not really clear. Trump is he blusters a lot. He hasn't invaded or bombed that many countries. So to the extent that we can take this opportunity and force it into a discussion of, you know, why Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State, other than that, I mean, is he the diplomat that we need, you know, right now? I think that's a fair question, because it's not clear to me that he has any real bona fides that qualify him, you know, particularly as a Secretary of State.
So Rand Paul's quote on this was, "I don't think you really want people who are eager for war to be running the State Department. You want a diplomat." I frankly think that Pompeo's positions are too much of an advocate for regime change really everywhere. And it's sort of interesting to me to see this debate playing out now under Trump, because in a lot of ways, this is just a debate about foreign policy under George W. Bush and what Republicans and sort of the last era of Republicans having a not good but coherent foreign policy. And since George W. Bush, Republicans have kind of, on the one hand, been like, well, George W. Bush was total overreach and he wanted to bomb everywhere and that was a bad idea and we should sort of rethink what we were doing under Bush and that whole program. And then on the other hand, like the core of the Republican Party has basically defaulted back to a kind of Bushian understanding of foreign policy that's quite hawkish and quite aggressive basically everywhere in the world anytime they have the opportunity. And Trump ran on a kind of let's not call it quite anti-war, but he was much
yes,
more skeptical.
Let's not call
he was much
that.
More skeptical of foreign intervention during the campaign
and
than other Republicans.
Of regime
and
change,
now he's
yeah.
nominating Mike Pompeo, who is basically an avatar of the very conventional George W. Bush hawkish Republican foreign policy establishment, because in part just because there aren't that many alternatives in the Republican Party. They've never really found another way to go, another place to go. Rand Paul is one of the very few Republicans who has any kind of clear sense of direction beyond, well, maybe let's not do what George W. Bush did. Let's do a different something else that is also strong well, in strength know, in America. And right. And it's just sort of this very odd situation where Republicans, on the one hand, spend a lot of time saying George W. Bush was wrong and then never really figured out why, how, or what they thought instead.
Well, one of the ways to kind of redirect the conversation is to point out that it you know, this didn't end. We forget the 8 years of Obama and Obama foreign policy at, you know, a great misfortune, and that perhaps Trump would be, you know, would be receptive to the idea that he shouldn't be fulfilling Hillary Clinton's foreign policy ambitions, because Hillary Clinton was an unapologetic believer in regime change, at least through the Libya invasion, which worked out so poorly. And this may be a way to kind of get under Republican skin or into their consciousness that they're actually dragging Trump from what he ran on to actually fulfilling what seemed to be Hillary Clinton's idea of good foreign policy.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the other big story from this weekend, which was the Cambridge Analytica story. I want to go to Liz to talk about this a little bit because she's been looking into it. What is the deal here? I think a lot of people are now seeing these words, Cambridge Analytica, for the first time and wondering, you know, is this that everybody panic moment or is it not?
No. I don't think it is. At least there's no evidence that it is yet. And I also did not hear anything about this until early this morning, but I wake up early, and so I've read a lot about
That's
it.
That's a long
then.
Time for you. That's like,
I know, yeah.
This is like basically a full work day for the rest of
exactly.
us.
Exactly. So I've been reading everything I can about it, and I think that this whole controversy, and I'll explain the basics in 1 second, but just to sum up, I think that this whole controversy sort of mirrors some of the controversy over Russian election meddling and influence on Facebook and things like that in general, where people are sort of ascribing magical powers to what are pretty traditional marketing techniques, but because it's got this veneer of being connected to Trump or whatever, that you know, people are freaking out. Basically, there is this professor at the University of Cambridge, and he did what is traditional for Facebook, which is he created an app and he applied to do the thing where, you know, when you are signed into an app, when you sign into Instagram or Pinterest or whatever, any sort of thing, you can, you know, just log in with Facebook. And so when you do that, there's always that little thing like, do you give Facebook the right to see your friend list or your whatever? It's individualized by the thing. If they want to get more data, they have to apply with Facebook for this special Facebook login. So this British professor got one. He got the data. Then he gave it to Cambridge Analytics. And that's where Cambridge Analytics come in, because he's not supposed to pass it on to anybody else. It's not illegal. It's just a violation of Facebook's terms of services. So they said, you know, hey, they found out in 2015 and they said, hey, you're not allowed to give this to other people and you have to delete it. And they have to delete it. And they all said that they did. And now it's come out this week that Cambridge Analytics worked with the Trump campaign during the summer of 2016 to do targeted advertising online on Facebook and elsewhere, sort of using, well, they, people said, you know, probably using this data. Cambridge has now said they did not use this data that they got from Facebook because they'd already deleted it, and they did not use it for their work with the Trump campaign. Facebook's now saying there's evidence that somebody didn't delete it. It's unclear if Cambridge Analytics or the professor or whoever, and that's why they've suspended all of them from Facebook right now. But the big thing is sort of, I guess, that even if they had used it for the Trump campaign, and even if, you know, Cambridge says that there's no evidence that that they did not use this data for the 2016 campaign. But even if that was incorrect and they did, I mean, that the only thing that they would have been doing is sort of using sort of basic things about people's friends or region or whatever to target ads based on them, which is famously what Obama did in 2012 and what many, you know, consumer and political campaigns do all the time.
Right. So there's this weird phenomenon, right, where when, you know, when like I think we could go back even as far as Howard Dean or Obama.
Nobody remembers him.
Nobody remembers. Use data. Oh, God. That was horrible. Howard Dean scream. Okay. When they use data, it's a revolution in politics that's going to result in smaller donors and save us all from the big corporate money. And when Republicans do it, it's the end of privacy as we know it. Obviously, I don't have a dog in that particular fight, but right. Is that fair to say that's how this seems to be shaking out?
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, it doesn't help that this guy, the Russian professor, the British professor, but he's got a Russian name and he's got maybe ties to Moscow. So everyone's like, oh, you know, like his firm is also don't work with them. So everyone's trying to tie this into sort of a larger narrative. And I guess, you know, who knows? It still could be, but there doesn't seem to be any basis for that right now.
Peter, one thing you and I were talking about last week, I wrote up a piece about Facebook banning Britain First and the accounts of their two leaders, which they did after many warnings and because of, again, a sort of similar question of whether it's a violation of terms of service. In this case, the terms of service, though, were about hate speech, right? So this is not a contractual arrangement. This is a kind of a more philosophical thing, which they do make clear on their website what the standards are. They're probably interpreting them somewhat differently in different cases, though. So Britain First is a splinter group from essentially the British nationalist / fascist party, and its leaders are really gross human beings who like stand outside of Muslim owned
like
businesses.
Than the Toxic Avenger,
like definitely. I don't know who that is, but for sure worse than that. And there's a you know, I think there's a question here of whether, you know, how we're supposed to think about Facebook. Is it a public utility? Is it a walled garden? Is it a, you know, just a company that people do business with in a standard way? And what does it mean if our politicians see it one way or another?
Well, people are seeing Facebook whatever way is convenient for them in the particular moment. So Facebook, on the one hand, wants to sort of act as like a public utility in a lot of ways. They want to present an image of themselves that is, we are an open platform for literally everyone at all times with no real restrictions. And it's just sort of this, we just support free speech and we never take any kind of action or anything, except then clearly sometimes they do. And so, you know, then you also have critics of Facebook, which on the one hand really want Facebook to be cracking down on, you know, on hate speech or on certain types of political advertising or even on privacy issues, sort of, you know, so that they can't decide to show you ads for shoes that you might like or whatever. And at the same time, those people are often taking the line that Facebook is a public utility and must be regulated as such, even though what they're really arguing is that Facebook should act like a private club and enforce private club rules. And Facebook is a private company and needs to embrace that identity and act like it. Because what Facebook is doing and what Facebook has the right to do is to determine who gets to use their service and when and how. And I think that that's, you know, that's something that's totally fair. But the problem is, and sort of the complication with all of this, is that Facebook constantly acts as if it's not really a private company, as if it's this sort of open global service that's just there for anyone and to do anything they want with, when in fact, they are the equivalent of a very large scale kind of mega private club online that can allow people to use their service when they want, and also tell people, you know what, you've gone too far, you're banned from the club for a month, for a year, forever. And I think that that's something that's totally okay, and that Facebook should be okay with saying, we do that, but that means that they need to sort of accept that as part of their image.
Liz, one thing that you've covered a lot is the difference in how people react when they think Ruskies are somewhere in the equation. Can you talk a little bit about both the kind of Russian trolling scandal as beating this, and then also, as you say, the vaguely Russian-sounding name of the protagonist here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there definitely is that. The guy's name is Alexander with no E at the end, just a DR.
Ooh, and then, yeah, so sinister, you know, it's
obviously
conjunction
a sinister
of consonants.
Yeah, there. But Also, though, just, I mean, what Peter said, too, though, about the idea that people have no principles here. I mean, I just was thinking of, I wrote for us a few weeks ago, about 2 weeks ago, about Facebook's censoring a picture of the Venus de Willendorf, which is one of the oldest, you know, Stone Age artifacts.
And it's extremely racy. I mean, I was offended looking at your
It looks a lot like a Pillsbury dough roll, like before, when it's only half baked, is pretty much what it looks like. But
but it has boobs.
Yeah, Liz. But it has like boobs. And so people, when I wrote this story, and it, you know, got a lot of people on both the left and the right who were like, this is ridiculous. And you had, you know, publications and stuff talking about it where everyone could agree that this was ridiculous. But then you have the left who, when it comes to, you know, this amorphous hate speech, thinks it's totally fine. And you have the right who, or at least some of the Trump right, who thinks when it's, you know, stuff about Russian meddling, then we need to like crack down on it. So it's just, you know, yeah, it's whatever people's pet things are is totally right.
If I can add, though, I mean, part of the main source of confusion here is actually Facebook and Facebook's delusions of grandeur of itself, because the whole point is that Facebook doesn't want to say, oh, yeah, you know what we are? We're Club Penguin for adults and we're going to enforce our terms of service. They want to be revolutionary and radical and inclusive, and they want to be an agent in global change and all of that kind
of
stuff.
Well, they want to have global market share, right? And have and be able to sell literally everyone's data to literally everyone.
Except Cambridge Analytica.
Well,
this is the, you know, there's also a larger question going on here, because exactly the same types of things are, you know, happening when you look at something like Twitter or Google and the way that they deal with data and their services. And it undercuts the utopian impulses of online leaders to be like, oh, yeah, actually, we're not really any different than a telemarketer or a catalog company or something like that. And adding to that, too, is that I think Liz is absolutely right that the Russian angle here is important, because and it's Russia today, but it'll be other things. In the 1950s, when there was a lot of Cold War paranoia, but also shifts in the economy and the way that things were being marketed after World War II, for the first time with television, there were robust national commercial advertising campaigns and whatnot. And you got a lot of people, both on the right and the left, were freaked out. And you got books like The Hidden Persuaders by Vance Packard, which said what he called the depth boys. These were people who knew psychology really well. And they could sell shit to ice cubes to Eskimos, because they knew what we were thinking before we even knew what we wanted, et cetera. All of it is kind of fake. And when popular culture, this, you know, comic books were big in the 50s, and they became somehow mired in, you know, like the rise in juvenile delinquency. We're going through a lot of social, economic, and kind of global changes right now. So people are desperate to look for deep conspiracies that explain everything, when the actual reality is a lot more uninteresting. And in this case, I think with Cambridge Analytica and a lot of other stuff, what everybody's trying to deal with is the fact that Hillary Clinton lost an election that she should have won. And nobody is willing, you know, on some level, Republicans don't want to admit it, but Democrats don't either, that it's like Hillary Clinton lost because she ran one of the shittiest campaigns in presidential history. And it's bizarre, but it's like, if we're going to be paying for her loss by having all of these services put under suspicion and having our free speech limited or having our rights of association, that's, you know, I didn't vote for her in the first place. I don't want to pay these auxiliary charges down the road either.
I would just add to this that people who are concerned about this, part of the issue is that they leverage data on just a couple of 100,000 people to begin with into data on something like 50 million people. And that's sort of the concern here, is that this small amount of data on a relatively small number of users became information on a much larger number of users. Basically, that, you know, sort of there was a friends to, you know, a friends of friends kind of one hop or two hop leap there.
It's chain migration.
Right. It's chain migration. Chain
informational change migration. Chain migration.
And, yeah. And, you know, that's, if you're worried about that, then what you're worried about is social media, period. Because that is the entire thing about social media, is that it doesn't just connect me to my close circle of friends. It connects me to the next layer of people who are my friends of friends, and the layer of friends after that. And that, like, if that's your concern, then it's not Donald Trump that you should be worried about. It's not Cambridge Analytica. It's the entire concept of social media, which was used by Obama this way, which is used by basically every major corporation this way, which is part of pretty much every social media network. And so, I actually think that there's a place for a discussion about how people want to share their data and whether they're and privacy concerns surrounding social media. But the concern, the issue here isn't Donald Trump connected with a firm that did this. This is the core insight of social media and how it works.
Well, and the core much.
I think you're
much, the core much.
I think you're right
about how. Like Nick was saying about TV, though, and how. Yeah. You know, this is always a debate that's been going on. How much influence does this sort of stuff have on people? Cambridge Analytica actually tweeted this morning, you know, advertising is not coercive. People are smarter than that. This isn't a spy movie. We're a data analytics company doing research and analysis on commercial public data sets for clients of all political mainstream persuasions. So
I agree. And, it is about social media and it's about a new form of communication. And this would be right now, the way we're talking about it would be as if, 100 years after Gutenberg, we said, writing gets passed around in ways that are different than if you can only talk to people, and whisper to them something. The only thing we can do is really put limitations on printing, because it's a dangerous technology that disrupts the way that we've been communicating. The fact is that the better solution is to say, okay, this is what social media does. It's clearly useful, and that's why people want it and keep participating in it. What we need to do is to come up with better ways to be literate about it and thoughtful about how we allow it to affect us, because it isn't a magic spell. It's something that we participate in.
Actually, that example is very on point. My pinned tweet for like a year now or something has been, there's the 2017 version of tech panic, which is our smartphones making us stupid. There's the 2008 version, which is Google making us stupid. There's the 1884 version, our books making us stupid. And in fact, we can go all the way back to some Socratic dialogues where the question is asked, is writing making us stupid? If people write things down, they will no longer use their minds, and then all of civilization will crumble. So
I think books are still making me stupid.
Yeah, writing is making me stupid for sure. It's a real problem. But I think the other thing about this version of this fight, which is a fight we've been having for a long time, is we used to worry that advertising was making people want things they didn't want, that, children would never think to eat Fruit Loops unless these commercials were played on cartoons. And now the panic seems to be advertising is so good and specific, it's making people really, really want the things they already wanted, which is somehow also bad. And it's not at all clear. Again, there's this sort of, is advertising voodoo magic? And if so, are we mad because it's making us want different things, or because it's making us double down on the same things?
Like, I definitely
prefer... You can't be against all of that.
I definitely prefer the world of targeted advertising.
Sure.
I mean, like, I like seeing advertisements for things that I am more likely to want. And probably I have bought some things that I wouldn't have bought otherwise.
But you enjoyed those things. You were happy to have them.
Because I wanted them.
Yeah.
I think there's an obsession, too, with trying to figure out with the Russia stuff, did they try to influence the election for Donald Trump or just against Hillary? And it's like that's such hubris that's even the way we're framing the question to begin with, because like maybe neither. Like, there are possible reasons that have to do nothing with what happens in the United States, that have to do with, their position relative to us in the broader political sphere at the time. And I think that's kind of a thing that we never stop to consider. Like maybe the effect wasn't even intended, whatever effect, to really be about who won our elections, but just to be about,
it could be a proof of concept for how to be involved.
Chaos in general, so that we're,
Yeah, I actually think that's
what Russia's doing on in other places at the time.
Well, this,
I think that's a,
if you remember the recent package of ideas about whose dystopia is it that Mike Riggs put together at Reason.com, this all feeds into that fear, which took off from the idea of an article about how we're living in Philip K. Dick's dystopia. And I think in some way we are, like, we're always afraid that we're being programmed by somebody or something. And it might be by class if you're a Marxist, it might be by gender if you're a feminist, it might be by genetics if you're a Darwinian, or by by secret forces, and Russians if you were an anti-communist, or Facebook if you're an anti-capitalist, et cetera. And it's, you know, it's an ongoing conversation. We're always afraid that we're not an individual, and we're just a puppet at the end of a string. And, you know, there's so little proof of that. And then if it is true, like, what are you going to do? You know, you got to live your life, right? You got to click on everything that comes up in your Facebook feed, and you have to buy every advertisement that you see, the product in that, and you have to vote for every candidate who advertises.
I also just feel like
it kind of takes care of itself.
People sort of overestimate the sophistication of a lot of targeted ads, because the basic theory of targeted ads seems to be, if you bought something once, you'll buy it again. So I bought a couple of years ago, I bought a reasonably nice messenger bag from a company called Timbuktu. And it's like, it's a great bag. I'm super happy to have it. You should buy one. I don't get,
paid targeted advertising, right, so from Peter Zuderman.
We don't do the mattress ads on this podcast. And it's a great bag. And for like 6 months afterwards, all I saw anywhere on the internet were ads for Timbuktu messenger bags. These are messenger bags that are like sold as the last one you will ever need. They'll last you for your entire life. And the whole, like, the idea of the tracking was, hey, you bought one Timbuktu messenger bag. Do you want a second one?
I 3 months later, 6 months later. I have the same thing right now with wedding dresses.
Wedding dresses.
I'm getting married, and I have the same thing with wedding dresses. So yeah. It's like,
have you bought like nine of them as a result?
Yeah, it's like, you know, everyone needs a couple.
Solid way. You can't help yourself. You
if
wake
I
up.
If I can, the darkest meme or version of that was a couple of years ago. We ran a documentary at Reason about a man, John Utley, who writes and publishes The American Conservative and has published in Reason and elsewhere. But his father was a Soviet trade official who was killed in a Russian work camp in Siberia. And after there was a documentary done on him finding out exactly where and when his father was shot and killed in this camp, and it had never been shown before. And after we ran that, Reason.com was served up with ads for Russian brides. For like 6 months. So that's kind of the level of sophistication. Well, it's like, you know, you like hearing about somebody purged under Stalin, so you're probably going to want to hire a mail order bride from Russia.
Nick, I do want you to know that those ads are actually tailored to your own searches. So, you know,
yeah,
Russian
I
brides.
I understand
just
that. So that's
flagging that for
so
you.
So, in fact, it was the Russian brides thinking that I might be interested in learning about the history.
I think
of Russia,
that's right. Yeah.
I never get sex robot ads.
Yeah, that's disappointing because they don't exist. I heard from Liz Nolan Brown, because there's no reputable company that actually sell them.
They must know your finances, Liz, and your ability to get a loan to buy a sex robot.
Those Russian brides all needed wedding dresses. Maybe they should be looking at your.
It's all coming together.
Liz?
I do think that Liz's point in particular, though, that, you know, viewing this conversation at any level through a red, blue, American political electoral lens misses the point so spectacularly. And the desire to make these sort of somewhat technical stories intelligible to the general public and sensationalize them seems to have a lot to do with why we're covering it this way. But yeah, the idea that somehow like Jesus arm wrestling with the devil and saying like, if Jesus wins, then Hillary Clinton will be defeated. Like the idea that was what swayed the outcome of our election seems really
well. And think of Hillary, even, you know, when in that speech that she gave recently to an Indian audience, where she was talking about how, you know, the reason she lost wasn't because white women didn't like her. White women were just being run by
their
you know, I mean, she said like their husbands, their boyfriends, their sons. So that, you know, even a 12-year-old kid could be like, hey, Ma, don't vote for Hillary. She stinks. Vote for Trump. You know, I mean, this impulse to ascribe actions or outcomes we don't like to some dark, nefarious conspiracy is, you know, it's fucking bananas. But it's also, you know, it just comes and it comes up and again and again and again throughout human history.
Speaking of dark, nefarious conspiracies, let's talk about the WTO for a minute. Was that a good Matt Welsh style segue? How did I do?
That was very good.
Okay.
Yeah, extremely well.
The question is whether Donald Trump is going to break the WTO. He's been talking a lot about trade, about how to get a better deal, how to win at trade for a long time. And the question now is whether the steel tariffs and aluminum tariffs that we were talking about last week have now become a model for how trade negotiations will be happening going forward. In particular, according to an Axios write-up and some other sources, Trump is obsessed with the word reciprocal. He's mad because the U.S. is imposing lower tariffs on some foreign-made goods than those countries have on our goods. Peter, is reciprocal the right word to describe how our trade relations should function with the world?
Nope.
All right.
Yeah. Tell us more, Peter.
Look, I mean, it's amazing that Trump knows this word at all. I'm pretty sure he just learned it, and that's, you know, explains half of his obsession. Trump's whole theory here is that because there is a difference between the tariffs that other countries or other trading blocks have and the United States' tariff. For example, the European Union has a 10% tariff on all cars, including those made in America. China has a 25% tariff on foreign-made cars, and the U.S. only has a 2.5% tariff on foreign cars we import. Trump's idea is, well, we ought to be able to at least threaten and perhaps even implement making those tariffs exactly the same both ways. It's a crazy idea because tariffs are just taxes. I mean, they functionally act exactly like taxes on goods brought into the United States. And so what Trump is basically saying is that because other countries have foolishly decided to tax goods being brought into their country from the United States, we should raise in a reciprocal fashion. We should raise our taxes on those goods and make things more expensive for ourselves. This is like saying that because somebody on the other side of a war you're fighting has decided to shoot themselves in their foot, you should also shoot yourself in the foot before you head out into the battlefield. It's just ridiculous. And it really shows the like incredible lack of sophistication of Trump and Peter Navarro, his sort of most protectionist economic advisor when it comes to thinking about trade. Trump has been told by his advisors that this is a bad idea, that this is not how trade works, that if he did this, it would probably spark an even worse trade war. And he just won't listen because Trump doesn't listen, especially when it comes to issues like trade.
I hate to be that Washington pundit person, but I feel like I need to go look and see if I put anywhere on the record, like the day after Trump was elected, I recall thinking, the thing that's good, like the stage of the greatest conflict of Trump's first term is going to be the WTO. Like that's where he's going to make the biggest mess and possibly have the biggest long term consequences. He's going to break the admittedly weird, jury rigged, ass backward way that we run global trade. I mean, it is a totally strange setup. On the other hand, it kind of works okay, and
it works better than breaking it down.
Yes.
It's not ideal, but breaking down the WTO with high tariffs or the threat of high tariffs, and with this sort of these like dumb New York developer braggadocio tactics that are likely to just sort of like make other companies irritable and start either trade wars or sort of cold trade wars with other countries is nearly certain to be worse than whatever flaws the WTO has.
So a best case scenario, though, is that Trump uses these negotiations not to raise our tariffs, but to get other nations to lower theirs. Nick, do you think there's any chance that that's what could actually happen? And also talk to me about Larry Kudlow and how he influences this mix.
Those are related and interesting questions. But, you know, one of the places where I think I don't think that Trump's tariffs are going to shatter the WTO. And if the consensus that lowering tariffs globally and making free trade easier or making trade more free for the past 70 years or so hasn't been a boon to everybody, you know, then if the consensus is so weak that it can be shattered by something like this, it's a sign that the WTO, something like NATO, has probably outlived its usefulness. I think what we're seeing again is the end of the post-war consensus, post-World War II consensus, starting to run out of steam because we need something new and we need either a restatement of basic principles that we get a global consensus on to kind of renew these institutions, or we have to come up with something different. The fact is that tariffs now globally all over the place are a mere fraction of what they used to be, and that's been good. And it's one of the main reasons why there are fewer poor people in the world, all of that kind of stuff. Having said that, Trump may be onto something because, say, less so with a trading bloc like the EU, but more with China, which has a bunch of other things. If your ambition to interact with China is not simply on economics, but also to get them to, I don't know, take care of North Korea or to act in a different way in their region of influence, this might be something where you say, "Hey, we're gonna make it more difficult for you to do business in the U.S." unless you do these other things. So, you know, there's a chance that there's actual diplomacy going on here that we don't know about. It seems doubtful because Trump, as Peter pointed out, seems to be not just ignorant, but hostile to basic economic concepts and understandings, which brings me to Larry Kudlow. Kudlow has always been a huge free trade guy. At the same time, he is also very much of a situational economist. And he will, he's not coming in there to tell Trump. Like, Trump didn't name him as an economic advisor so that he could finally learn about the benefits or the gains from trade from a guy who talks that way. He brought in Larry Kudlow because he knows him and he likes him, and then he's going to use Kudlow to carry whatever message he wants. So I think the idea that Trump's economic advisors are somehow really going to be persuasive seems highly unlikely at this point. And it's more that you bring in somebody in the same way that Barack Obama brought in Christine Romer as the head of his Council of Economic Advisors chief, and had her renounce her entire academic the work that made her academic reputation to support stuff like stimulus spending. You don't bring in economic advisors to learn from them. You bring them to certify what you want them to do.
Since Matt Welsh is out due to psychosomatic laryngitis, I do want to flag here a thing that I think he would say, which is, as always, we should listen to what Donald Trump says he's going to do, but then we should also evaluate whether or not he can do it. Since there is a role for Congress here, and since Congress, even congressional Republicans, even as they betray many of the principles that we would like them to have, they are probably not going to back this trade scheme. And so that may be a break on any of this happening in the world.
It will, but it's also true that, you know, people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have already been talking about how, you know, on this, Trump isn't so far off, and they don't want to say anything good about anything Trump says, but they do agree. They do agree that tariffs, like higher tariffs and selective tariffs, should be part of American trade policy and maybe even foreign policy. And that's where I mean, like, you know, the American consensus might be shifting away from free trade. We've already seen when Obama was in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, more Republicans were against free trade agreements than Democrats. We need a restatement that speaks to more people about why free trade is good, and that it is not just good because it makes things cheaper in the short run, but that it's good because it grows the economy and helps poor people, helps economic mobility, and helps economic growth in the long term. Trump, again, I think, is more of the effect rather than the cause of things.
Liz, is this going to be the moment that we finally get the long-awaited Trump Democratic, you know, like socialist-leaning Democrats coalition that we've been looking for in Congress?
Sure. And then we'll also get all the, you know, limited government Republicans on the libertarian side.
Good. Excellent. Solid plan.
How many of them are there?
Yeah. All of them. All
three quarters.
There's a couple.
There's several three quarters of them.
Yeah. This is a long debated topic. So before we end this podcast, I want us to do our traditional podcast kicker, which is to talk about what we are consuming. And Peter always wants to call this segment,
"Have You Seen?"
Have You Seen?
Because that's how we do it in the office. Have you seen? Counterpart?
Yeah.
Have you seen?
But it's really
West
not just
World?
Have you seen. It's also have you eaten? Have you, you know,
have you been
listened
to?
Have you
read?
Yeah.
Hey, man, have you played?
Let's start with Elizabeth Nolan Brown, special guest Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Liz, what have you seen?
I hope I'm allowed to do something that's not new, because I've been rewatching Westworld recently because it's about to premiere again. The season two premieres on April 22nd, and I'm trying to, you know, reacquaint myself with all the mysteries so that I have, you know, can figure things out this time. Like last time, there was the big twist and people figured out ahead of time, and I want to do that this
Liz,
time.
Liz, Westworld is like all of your beats.
Yeah.
So I anticipate some good ENB Westworld coverage coming up. In fact, we've been talking here at Reason about going all in on Westworld this season, maybe some kind of debate discussion. So listeners, if you have thoughts about that, tweet at us, give us a yay or nay.
You didn't watch season one, you should.
Do you think, is there any way that Westworld can deliver on the, you know, the what it's really, it had a great first year. And like, do you think there's any way that it's actually going to build on that and become better? Or is it going to become, I don't know, like the series of unfortunate events books and just kind of like, eh, you know, and kind of deflate slowly and undramatically?
Yeah, I was skeptical too, I think, just thinking back on last season and thinking about this one. But now that I've been rewatching it, I'm actually, there's things I'm noticing that it's like, it's kind of a thing that didn't even get developed at all, but could be a game changer for this season if they wanted it to. So I think there's enough in there that it could sustain it.
Peter, have you seen anything good?
There is supposedly a 5-year plan for 5 seasons of Westworld that they developed during their hiatus.
Oh. 5-year plans are never good, dudes.
Yeah.
From a certain perspective.
Except for agriculture. Yeah, they never work out.
So I have been feeling a little under the weather for the last week, and I've been playing a lot more video games than usual. I've been playing a game that came out last year called Horizon Zero Dawn. It basically has all of the game mechanics of open world games, like all of them. It is every mechanic that you've seen in an open world game pretty much since Grand Theft Auto 4 and the original Assassin's Creed. You've got the climb the tower to expose the new stuff at the zone. You've got the like run around and grab resources, which you then have to craft to make basic stuff and also to upgrade your stuff. It's got the like shoot the target, like the targeted zone on the enemy. It's got the secondary layer of vision in this case, because this game takes place in a sort of post-apocalyptic world that is like not just after the fall of technology, but like after the fall of technology several times over, and people have kind of reverted to this weird sort of like almost Garden of Eden state, except there are robot animals and dinosaurs running around everywhere. And typically I don't love these sorts of games these days. I really haven't enjoyed one since some of the original Assassin's Creed games, but I'm finding that this one is really nicely balanced, even though it is basically a kind of busy work game. Just the thing that stuck out most to me in this game, as in so many of these big open world games these days, there's just so much stuff to do, so many tasks that you have to accomplish, and it really begins to feel like work at some point. And in fact, one of the categories of quests that they have that you can go on is literally called errands. And so if you would like to play a video game that has a bunch of errands, I highly recommend Horizon Zero Dawn. It's a great way to kill 20 or 30 hours of a week.
Are you selling this game, or are you making sure that we don't stumble into it by accident?
Peter? Yes.
You know, it sounds stunningly like everyday life, you know.
I mean, look, if you really enjoy going around and shooting robot dinosaurs with your fire bow as part of your everyday life, and then picking some weeds and like cutting down some trees to make more arrows and upgrade your craft, your pouches, so that you can hold more arrows and more sticks and weeds, so that you can make even more medicine, so that you can kill more fire, more dinosaur robot creatures, so that you can finally
Stop.
Discover the
oh my
mystery
God,
of yeah. how this world was created after something like
so
80
finally
hours of gameplay.
A world even more tedious than Minecraft.
I've never played last. Minecraft.
Nick, what have you seen that's good?
I have been watching my channel for new stuff to watch, particularly. I watch a lot of series, documentaries, and things like that. And I, my 16-year-old son is constantly pushing stuff my way. And the most recent thing that I've picked up from him is an anime show from Japan, which is a parody of anime shows called One Punch Man. And it is about a bored Japanese underemployed businessman who becomes One Punch Man, where he can vanquish any monster, any villain with a single punch, and then gets very bored because there's really nothing left to do. And it's very funny.
He could play Horizon Zero Dawn, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm sure he could. Or he could just smash the game with one punch. So it's very funny, and it's a really kind of great meta commentary on, I read it anyway as a kind of commentary on the exhaustion of, you know, of kind of an ironic era, because there's actually human feelings, even as it is endlessly parodying and satirizing its basic format and its basic genre. There's a constant attempt to become human and kind of show real emotion and real feeling. And I think that in a way is a pretty good simulation of where we're at as a society.
Yours?
It's on Netflix.
You guys' escapism sounds not very escapey. My recommendation is the Law and Disorder podcast, which has also been a radio show. It's been around forever. I had the chance to meet one of its hosts, Heidi Boghossian, this weekend, and in preparation listened to a bunch of episodes. It's so good, y'all. It's kind of like this podcast, except for every now and then they just say, and obviously unions are the greatest thing that's ever happened in history to make everything better. I mean, they are lefties, but they are primarily focused on criminal justice issues and civil libertarianism. And they do interviews with various figures. The one that I most enjoyed this weekend was a interview with two of the raging grannies, who are old ladies who just go like chain themselves to the fence in front of like DOD installations, and then basically say like, yeah, come break my hip, you pig, and see how it goes down.
Catherine and I attended Reason Weekend, an annual donor event that we have, and Heidi spoke on a panel with Lynn Ulbricht, who and she has written an amicus brief for Ross Ulbricht, the founder, now imprisoned, of the Silk Road website. But Catherine led a conversation there that was fantastic. And Catherine, I had no idea, but I was delighted that a Reason event had somebody on the panel who was actually saying that Mumia Abu-Jamal was innocent. And it was kind of a, you know, I didn't expect to hear that at a Reason event.
It was pretty great.
It's kind of mind-blowing.
It was pretty great that we accidentally wound up with this panel that had a big chunk in it that was like, did he really shoot that cop, though? It was fantastic. So those are our recommendations. And thank you to Peter and Nick. And especially thank you to special guest star Elizabeth Nolan Brown for joining me at the Reason podcast. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, or if you hated it, please subscribe at iTunes, rate and review us while you're there.